Beverly wants to know if the Tellurian plague gets cured in the future. Geordi wants a glimpse into next week's poker game. And Commander Riker is taller in person. Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Seventh Rule with Serac Lofton.
Hello.
My name is Ryan T. Husk, and today we are doing a review of Star Trek The Next Generation Season 5, Episode 9, A Matter of Time, written by Rick Berman. Interesting. Directed by Paul Lynch. This was November 16th, 1991. Where were you? How you doing today, Serac?
November 16th. I was around. I'm good. I'm doing great. How are you?
Doing just fine, thanks. Everybody, please make sure you like this video, subscribe to the channel, hit the bell icon for notifications. If you're listening in, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. We'd really appreciate that. Also, visit us on patreon.com/the7th rule. We would really appreciate and enjoy having you part of the show. So, Serac, this is an episode. Every once in a while, there's an episode where I'm like, I don't remember this one too well. And every once in a while, there's an episode where I go like, I remember this one very well. This is the latter. I remember this one very well. I've seen it a bunch of times. I knew the character. I remembered the moral of the story. I remembered the situation. It's a very memorable episode because it's not like any episode that I remember ever seeing in Star Trek. Star Trek oftentimes has like 3 or 4 or 10 episodes that are very similar. This one is not that. There's a twist I didn't see coming. And so I just remember it well. So the entire time, all I was thinking was, but what does Serac think about this episode?
Well, that's a lot. What before I say what I think about it, what was memorable about this episode for you that you know, what is the thing that you walk away with when you think of this episode?
One was the main thing was the twist that the entire time you believe, or I believe, that there's something crazy that's going to happen. And this guy is a little suspicious, a little annoying. Maybe there's something to it. Maybe he takes part in something. But I never would have thought that he was just a thief from the past who stole a ship from the future to go in the middle and steal things and bring them back to his past, which is our, yours, and my future, and be an inventor and invent those things. You know, it's like, but it totally makes sense. It works. So it was just like an interesting twist. And that's what made it memorable, was it was the twist itself. Now, the character, of course, is played, you know, hilariously by the guy that plays Max Headroom, if you remember Max Headroom.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Matt Frewer is his name, Matt Frewer. He's been in a bunch of stuff. But yeah, he's definitely a character actor that is very, like, he added a ton to this episode. Kind of the same way that Kivas Fajo did. Remember the Kivas Fajo character that just kept adding all these weird, interesting deliveries and thoughts and whatever, you know?
Yeah.
This guy did that in kind of an annoying way, but certainly interesting.
Certainly an annoying way.
Like in this picture behind me, of course. Look at Data's like looking away. Like,
yeah, the facial expressions of the crew's annoyance with him was one of my favorite things of the episode. Riker was the best of them all, I thought.
Yeah.
There was just so many looks that he gave. Picard eventually caught on board to the dislike train. And it seemed like everybody had an issue with him. And you rarely see that, right, where a character is disliked by everybody. Crusher, Data.
Crusher had a little something for him, but it was kind of like she was intrigued, but also a little bit like two steps back, bro.
Yeah. For me, first of all, this character reminded me of the other actor who plays on this show, Murdoch from the
Barkley, 18th. Right? Barkley, Dwight Schultz.
Dwight Schultz.
Totally. Yes, totally.
And the interesting thing is, Dwight Schultz is playing his character on Star Trek opposite how he plays on the A-Team. And Matt here plays this character like Dwight Schultz's character from the A-Team. So this guy
Good
is
point.
exactly like Murdoch from the A-Team to me. This is you could have dropped Murdoch in this episode.
Yeah, totally.
And it was Murdoch, because Murdoch is always annoying like that. He's always like in asking these questions, getting under people's skin a little bit. You know how Mr. T used to hate looking at him and just like, oh, this guy's just enough with this guy, you know? And I felt like that's how this character was played. This character is Murdoch from the 18.
Yeah, Murdoch is very Robin Williams too. Just like a joke a minute, always on, always on. Kind of like this guy. This guy had a little more smugness to it. Like, I know this is what was annoying about him. It's like when somebody is like hides something and you're looking for it, and they're like, well, you're getting warmer. Well, maybe I just tell me where the thing is. Like, enough with your smugness. But yeah, that's a really good point. It makes me wonder if had Dwight Schultz not been cast as Barkley, if he would have been their first choice for this character. And since he was already a known, memorable character without alien makeup, I mean, if he had alien makeup on as Barkley, I bet you they'd reuse him for this guy. That's a good point.
100%. He would be better than this guy. As good as this guy was at being annoying, you remember how good Murdoch was
Yes.
just peeking and poking around and just getting under your skin. And I felt like I was watching his twin. It was amazing to watch this performance, because I honestly felt like I was watching an A-Team episode of the Star Trek of Star Trek. Star Trek meets the A-Team.
Nice.
They just needed
Oh,
Worf to have some Mr. T jewelry on.
you know what they
What
would call it? They would call it
was
the
that?
OA team. The
Oh,
OA team, maybe. Maybe
all
they would, maybe they wouldn't.
right. I got two snaps. I'll give you two snaps
Thank you.
for
I'll take them both.
that. But yeah, first of all, I remember Paul Lynch. I worked with Paul Lynch on a few episodes. I had to look him up to remind myself of his face. He was relatively cookie cutter with his approach to this. It wasn't, any kind of groundbreaking stuff or, amazing camera work. And this episode didn't really require that. It was kind of a basics episode, what you would expect almost around this part of the season, because we're around the stretch where they start doing, I think, filler episodes. So to me, this is kind of a filler episode. I like this premise of the idea. I don't like necessarily the execution of it. I felt like it took a long time for that story to drag and drag, and I wish that they had executed in slightly a different way. And I can't
Oh.
say exactly what that way
Oh,
is.
bummer.
Well, I can say, for one, they could have used the B story in this. I don't re recall a B story.
Well, the B story was the stuff on the planet.
Okay.
But it was just so intertwined, these two stories. It was kind of like A and A.5, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I felt like that's, yeah. It basically felt like they were on one story. You're right. It was a very small margin between that gap. But I guess what I'm saying is, the pace that it moved at wasn't complex enough for me. The storyline wasn't complex enough for me. I do get the whole at the very end. That was good. I would have liked more. More ways of uncovering his deception. There could have been better ways to retrieve that. I felt like they didn't even investigate. If this guy is a human, you would suspect that even in the database for the Enterprise, that they would have a basically a database of his ancestry. Let's say he was from 300 years in the
Yeah,
future,
true.
they would look back at his ancestry and say, oh, the Rasmussens. Oh, that's right. He comes from the Rasmussens. They come, from the 20th century, the 17th century Rasmussens from the, you know what I mean? There would be more there. And they didn't investigate in that way to me. I didn't feel like they did any investigatory work on his claims. The other thing is, some kind of compound analysis of the ship that he was in. Some more investigatory work on behalf of the crew. I
And did
felt like they
you?
just kind of melded him in and just accepted him really easily, and yet everybody expected that he had some nefarious or hidden agenda. And so, if somebody did have that kind of level of hidden agenda, would you let them freely walk around the bridge? Would you let them freely
No.
have access to sensitive parts of your engine room and things of that nature? I wouldn't just, you know what I mean, have
Right.
all access granted to
And
some
Beverly
guy
felt
we
the
don't know
same
about.
way. She wasn't sure if she wanted to let him have access to sensitive parts, but she, considered it, I think.
I just felt like the character wasn't endearing enough or giving it enough background. So, for example, there would be certain language in Starfleet that he would be able to communicate if he had some kind of Starfleet connection, even though he wouldn't be able to reveal his connections or certain things, events that were going to unfold. There would be a language in which an officer would communicate with another officer who was part of Starfleet. I don't think, regardless of the timeline differentiality right there, I think an officer from World War I meeting an officer today will have a mutual language that they can communicate in based on the fact that they have a shared experience, regardless of the fact that the artillery was different, the machinery was different, tanks were different. There's still a language of commonality there in which you would be able to distinguish that somebody had some kind of service record.
That's a good point. And one thing I did not really remember about this episode, or just didn't pay attention to, was kind of the two people that get dismissed the most this time were the two people that were right. Worf always wants to have caution. He's always like, ready phasers. And they're always like, whatever, Worf. But this time he was right. And the other one is Troi. For once, she gave us something we didn't already know. In fact, she gave us something that was kind of counter to what the crew thought. She said, I don't trust him, basically. And they're like, oh, I'm sure it's fine. She's like, no, he's hiding something. They say, well, of course he's hiding something. He's from the future. He can't tell us stuff, And for once, we're like, hey, look at Troi actually doing, being written. A role that befits her skills. Now, it would have been cool if that was seen through. Like if Troi convinced Captain Picard to take some kind of precaution that led to him, like if she said something like, can we at least take every precaution to scan the inside of his ship, or something that paid off later, where we're like, he's like, good job, counselor. Or if Worf said, Worf and Troi are both talking, whatever. And then she's like, is there any way we can, keep an eye on this guy a little bit more? And he says, well, we can scan the ship once it's, something like that would pay off to where these two people that always get brushed aside or get useless lines got something that paid off right at the end, because we did get that payoff from Data and Picard, but it wasn't a payoff from anything that was set up at the
Yeah, it wasn't set
beginning.
up. Again, that's what I'm saying about how I think the way the storytelling was done. They told us that Picard said, when you open the door to your shuttle or your craft, that's when the ship's computer was able to scan the contents of your
And
vessel
deactivate.
and deactivate them. that investigatory work was never brought to our attention, right? That they were even suspecting that or looking for that. Even the fact that they knew that those items were missing. And so, again, they could have told us, Captain, there's some items missing and it seems odd. And then we would have had some investigatory work on, like you said, Troy and Worf working together. Well, scan the contents of his ship. We can't because his ship has a breach. Well, maybe if we get him to open the door, we can find, right? And so that kind of, you know what I mean? That
So
kind of storytelling.
here's what I'm thinking is the problem with that then is that it takes away the suspense and twist for us at the end. Because if they do that, then we're not frightened that he's going to get away. We're not, you know, we don't get that twist. But we can still meet in the middle, which is that happens, that plays out. You know, Troy and Worf have a conversation ahead of time where they're like every precaution, something like that. Then this thing plays out the way it does. Data walks him out, and then he says, you know, Picard has his line, but then he says, "Good work, Mr. Worf," meaning Mr. Worf was the one that came up with this thing and did this thing. And then now we have that through line that was built at the beginning. And we can still have that wonderful line by Data where he says, you know, "Would you like me to take you out conscious or unconscious," or whatever he said, which was, that's the best Data line, because he's just saying it like, you know, no, he says, I'm sure, I presume your handprint will work whether you're conscious or not. That's so Data. I loved it.
Yeah, you're about to get messed up if you don't cooperate. That's a great threat.
So good.
Yeah, so there were elements that I liked about it. There were some that I didn't. And for me, mainly it comes down to pace. And then there's another logical train that's being broken in my understanding of the Star Trek lore. And that is from the episodes that I remember seeing where time travel was done by the Federation, by the crew of Star Trek. They would always be covert. They would always be dressed up, trying to blend in and say, "Don't give away that we're here, that we're from a different time period." So, because that in itself messes the time. You know, the butterfly effect of messing up of time. And so most of the time sequences that I've seen in Star Trek have been done in a way where they say that they cannot reveal that they're time travelers and they keep that information concealed from people, right? I mean, that was just shown in the last episode of the last few season of Picard. When Picard goes back to Earth in that 2024, and with Rios's character basically marrying the girl and staying with them, but they were being covert about it, and he had to explain that to her, that he basically was from the future, but that was a personal thing that he revealed after a long time. That wasn't an announcement that he made the first thing that he got there. It's like, "Hey guys, I'm from the future, just checking things out." So to me, that in itself messes with time. If you just show up and say, "Hey, I'm here, and I can't tell you why I'm here, but I'm going to observe what you're doing, and here's some surveys for you to fill out."
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. Tell me all of your information.
Yeah, that part doesn't sit well with my logic. That's what I'm saying. If there was a thing where he was more covert about it, and he does pop up, and they say, "We noticed the temporal displacement." And he's like, "I can't say what I'm here for, and I can't even say what time period I'm from, but I have a mission to do, and I'd like to be left alone to do that mission." Instead of the more, "Hey guys, I'm from a time period, can't tell you, from the future, but can't tell you what's going to happen, but I'll tell you what is going to happen. These surveys that I got and this questionnaire, I'm just going to conduct a little census. And by the way, do you mind giving me access to all of your restricted areas on board the ship,
That was
all
the
the
weirdest
private?"
part, because they could be like, "Look, you're a historian, fine, we believe you. Fine, we give you access to the ship. But no, not all the secret things. Just because you say, don't worry, I already know about this stuff. Okay, well, if you already know about it, then you don't need to be walking through it. And all this stuff where he's like, ah, 7, 8, 9 meters. I was right. You guys don't have schematics of the Enterprise 200 years in the future. Of course, you got schematics of everything. You know what the ship was like. They have schematics of ships. We'll ask the Matt Boardman and Jason
Especially
Oaken.
a historian. So that means they have access to all of the high level stuff that's in libraries, all the stuff that's preserved, all the maps that have been handed
They could
down,
just
all the
say,
star maps.
computer, what were the dimensions of the captain's ready room on the USS Enterprise 1701D? And it would say, the captain's ready room was approximately 17 by 9, I was going to say feet, but they would say 4 by 6 meters or whatever, you know?
I just think that part of it was also suspicious to me, and I don't think that they were too welcoming and accepting to this person, and not enough suspicion there for me.
Okay, you know what that means? I suspect that it's time for our break, everybody. So we're going to jump over to our quick break and we will be right back on the seventh rule.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the seventh rule with Ciroc, the game changer, Lofton.
Game changing.
He even has his name on his beverage vessel there. Is that what I saw?
Oh yeah, this is Walking Art by Melissa.
Beautiful.
See that right there?
And I saw the Lofton at the bottom when he took a sip.
Yeah. Well done. Thank you, Melissa.
Walking art made by Melissa. Check it out. Get your very own Ciroc Lofton beverage vessel. Okay, here are the trivioids of the week because you are clamoring for them, everybody. Here they come. 21st century Earth has nuclear winters. Well, we're in that right now, as in the 21st century, not a nuclear winter. Beverly wants to know if the Tellurian plague gets cured in the future. Jordy wants a glimpse into next week's poker game. Professor Berlinghoff Rasmussen calls Data the Model T of androids. Data corrects him, of course. New Seattle is reporting a cloud depth of 12 kilometers. Rasmussen checks the time on his finger watch. Riker believes the warp coil was a big symbol of progress. Beverly is curious about Barrelite levels, and Commander Riker is taller in person. All right. Those may be the most boring trivioids I've ever pulled out. I've often wanted the trivioids to like the three at the beginning to not tell people what this episode is about unless they're like really good, you know, like if the trivioid at the beginning is, for example, Commander Riker is taller in person. Somebody that just saw this episode would be like, that's from that A Matter of Time. Or if you say, you know, the New Seattle is reporting a cloud depth of 12 kilometers. It would take, you know, a lot of Star Trek fans would be like, oh, what's that from? What do I remember that line. I'm, you know, and they try to figure it out. And these were the most trivial of the trivioids, I think.
trivial.
Pretty bad.
That's why this episode really ranks slow for me. It does move slowly. I found myself saying, pick up the pace on this thing. Give me some action. Give me something. Especially coming off of the two-parter we just had. We just had Spock.
I thought the same. A big ass two-parter in 507 and 508. And then we got
well,
with every
that's what
roller
I said.
coaster,
just
there's
yeah, you can, every... they just yeah. They broke the budget on Spock. They did a two-parter. What was that episode?
Unification.
Unification part 1 and 2. And, you know, I understand they would do a more of a bottle episode and, you know, something kind of less budgeted. This is just a lot of talking, you know, and just getting to watch facial reactions, for example, from the crew, which I did enjoy seeing those reactions in those scenes, those uncomfortability moments. I thought they were great.
I agree that most of my ha-ha moments in my notes were Riker kind of looking over or Worf going harumph, you know.
Yes.
Things like that. Most, those were the good
that
moves.
Was pretty much the whole thing for me. When Rasmussen sits down in Riker's chair on the bridge, they freeze on his glare for like at least 5 seconds.
He has such great reaction shots.
He looks at him like, you son of a, like the way he looks at him, right? It's a long look, you know, for a reaction shot. And then he looks at him. There's about 3 seconds. Then he moves his head over and he says something to, you know, command. But I thought, wow, he really doesn't like this guy. He wants to tell him off.
Riker's reaction shots are always second to none. Like, he's so
just
good.
Beautiful.
You could tell every time I watch Jonathan Frakes acting, I always think he acts like a director. It's like, as an actor, he's very cognizant of the big picture of what the director wants to see, sometimes to the detriment. Sometimes he overacts, like somebody falling over, goes like, huh? You know, which is like he overdoes it because he's thinking, okay, they need to watch me really react, you know. But in other times, like with these reaction shots, he conveys exactly what we want him to convey. And you know, the director's looking at this and being like, yes, precisely, Frakes. This is what I want. This is exactly it. And I love those from him.
Me too. And he is like the conscience of Picard. There's moments when he's looking like at Picard, like, you want me to punch this guy? And Picard's like, no. No, it's all right. Let me just, we'll deal with it a different way. But I do love his facial reactions. And, you know, other people had some good ones too. It wasn't just him. Like you said, Worf was fantastic for his grumpiness and, you know, but Brent Spiner's comedic timing
I know.
Is unparalleled. The way he did the scene where he was listening to like six different musics at the same time. And he does this thing that the camera only has one of his eyes in focus, basically. The other eye is kind of off, you know, off this way. And he's doing this, so he's saying, "Computer, remove program one." And then he looks over at the guy. The look over that he gives at the guy, it's like, is that satisfactory? You know,
no, another one. Okay, what about now? What about now?
And then, but there's a comedic look in that one eye where he's just giving you enough where it's like, it's just giving you enough comedy and Data's, you know, perception of things. It's fantastic.
Like when the guy washes his hands and he goes like this, and Data's like, and just plops it on his hands, like, okay, well, there you go. Fine.
Exactly. I love the way he, Data is fantastic for his reaction shots, his moments of comedy. He adds so much levity to things. And his curiosity to be about his own mortality was interesting. It was an interesting, like, you know, segue, just a small little insight to what he's thinking about. Because you rarely get those kinds of moments where you have a real look into what Data's thinking about, as opposed to just like processing information or calculations. But what is inside him, as you know, in a moment of fulfillment, like what he's kind of purpose that he's looking for, or something that he's looking for to be more human, and his quest to be more human. And it seems that even mortality is part of one of those things.
Right.
That, you know, his own mortality is a branch of him being human. And so to see himself in the future is like all of us wanting to see ourselves, our ancestry, people who look like us in the future. I think that was a poignant moment. It reflects to me about what Cisco's character means for Black people to see themselves in the future. So I kind of picked up from that vibe when I saw Data asking those questions. Even though he's an android, it's still the same human instinct of self-preservation.
You know, there was a similar philosophical moment for me when I was watching this. But it's on the negative side of the spectrum, if that's possible, which is when Rasmussen says, you know, when Picard's saying, hey, you know, these 20 million people are going to die. And Rasmussen says, well, everybody's going to die. From where I come from, they've already been dead for 200 years. You know, the only difference is when they're going to die or how, but they're already dead. And that's an interesting and, you know, obviously a humbling thought, which is, yeah, 200 years in the future, every single person here on this planet will have already died. And it truly doesn't matter how. They're in the past. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if they died at 17 or at 70. They died. They're dead. Who cares? It doesn't matter at all. To us, the people living, it totally does, but 100 or 200 years in the future, doesn't matter one lick of shit. You know what I mean? And I hope that's not a saying because that's gross. But but anyway, so that was interesting. But another, it was really philosophical. And another thing I was thinking of when you were talking about, you know, Data and his quest for humanity and all that, I was realizing this is one of the very few episodes, I believe, that Rick Berman wrote. Mm-hmm. All his own. There's no story by, there's no nothing. He wrote an episode. Yeah. So I'm thinking this is, as far as I know, and you know better than most, he was the tip of the spear of Star Trek. He was the, you know, like the current, the, you know, how Alex Kurtzman is currently. So when he writes an episode, it's almost like we are seeing the Next Generation characters in their purest form, because they're being written how they were intended by the person that is running the show, if that makes sense. When somebody else, you know, from Albuquerque comes in and writes an episode, it's their interpretation of the character. Sometimes they nail it, sometimes they don't. When Rick Berman is writing an episode, it's almost like these are the root personalities of these characters from which the other, you know, scripts and the other writers are driven. Is that anywhere? Are derived from. Anyway, so that's why it's kind of interesting to see Troy actually being useful in a way. Worf and his suspicions actually being correct. Riker having strong reservations and reactions, you know. All of those moments are very much like their character. You know, the only one that was a little peculiar was Beverly. Beverly being a little bit, she was the one that was a little smitten. You know, we haven't really seen that seed of her character in previous episodes where everybody's like, I don't like this guy. But Beverly's like, well, I don't know. He's kind of cute. We've seen him once or twice, like in a terrorism episode. But anyway, other than that, I felt like, you know, we're kind of watching them almost in their purest form of their personalities, if that makes sense.
Yeah, to some degree. I can see that, at least how Rick Berman wants them to be in his perception.
In his point of view, what he wants, right?
Yeah. But again, you know, that it wasn't that much. He was using the characters as, you know, he's obviously familiar with and helped create. But, you know, there was opportunity to tell the story in a better way. I don't know what it was. Here you have a time machine, right? There essentially is a time machine in this episode. A little tiny portable two-man, three-man time
machine.
Pod or whatever, that that only gets used once, which is to deliver this character into the episode, but never really gets used again. And then you have this other, the quote unquote B story, which is this terraforming of this planet and, you know, the dangers that were facing it based on the volcanic eruptions and whatnot. Say that there was a catastrophe that eliminated this planet and Geordi on it. Earlier in the story, or halfway through the story, then they have a time machine that they can utilize to help, you know, bring this story back around.
That's true.
Do you know what I mean? You know what I'm saying? And so, to me, this would have been a great episode about a time machine that was, you know, that has been hijacked, both, you know, from the past and brought back some a little bit into the future, but not all the way. So there's technology involved with this particular thing. It's pretty. It would be a special thing, right? To find, like if somebody from the future landed here in a spacecraft, would we be more talking? Well, I mean, there would be some of us that would be talking to the guy, but there would be a lot of us that'd be looking at the spacecraft and saying, "What the hell is this thing? How does it, you know, propel itself? How does it defy time?" You know, all of these kinds of things are not even a question for anybody, right? It's just, oh, it's a temporal state, and, you know, whatever. It's, you know, we always run into those things. I think that particular tool could have been used to advance the plot, to put some extra spin on the plot, to put more twist on the plot, to pick up the pace on the plot. You got a time machine that they barely use for 5 seconds. And I actually thought it looked pretty cool from the inside and the outside. It looked, the design was really, you know, it was unusual. And I liked that.
It was more unusual than I expected or remembered. When we saw it today, I was like, oh, wow, that's blocky. It's weird.
Yeah, angular.
Yeah, very angular, yeah. Yeah. that's a good point. I did... However, I think that the highlight of the episode was the conversation towards the end with Picard and Rasmussen, when Picard is saying, hey, you know, there's a lot of lives at stake. If you could just kind of give me, you know, a hint. He's like, oh, I can't say anything. And he's, oh, no, I would never ask you to say anything. However... if you were to, a lot of lives could be saved. You know, like that was a more interesting part of the episode, I feel, than what came of it, which was Picard saying, by not saying anything, you gave me all the information I wanted. You know, that's fine, I guess. But for me, the actual meat was before that, when they're kind of arguing, you know, these philosophical semantics and stuff like that. And, Picard was like, look, I have broken this law on a few occasions because it was the right thing to do. And you could also break that. And he's like, and don't give me any of that stuff about, you know, the baby that gets killed could turn out to be the next Hitler or the next Khan Singh or anything like that, which, by the way, was a non-appearance mention for Khan. You know, he's like, I know all that stuff. I'm just saying, right here, right now, there are a lot of lives at stake and they can be saved. I know in your future, it doesn't matter, but right now this is happening. Anyway, that's just, those are the fun kind of discussions with time travel episodes, more so than I could be your great grandfather kind of stuff like that. We've seen that a million times.
Yeah. I did like that exchange with Picard, because Picard was basically like, you know, playing poker with him and trying to get him to give up the goods on, you know, helping him out. You mentioned Rick Berman, and I think more than, you know, not more than, but in addition to it revealing how he perceives the character or wants to utilize the characters in problem solving.
Right.
I think it also reveals a lot about the man Rick Berman himself and his own tendencies, because You know, you write about what you know about. We saw that in many instances with, you know, a lot of the writers, in particularly the woman who's a lawyer who wrote on the beginning
Melinda Snodgrass.
Melinda Snodgrass.
Totally.
Exactly.
Yeah, you're right.
Measure of a Man. So you write about, you know, how what you know about. And what I feel like Rick Berman knows a lot about is some of the subject matter covered in this episode. One of them was recited by LaForge in his dialogue. He said, he said, there's no guarantee this is going to fail. They were talking about, hey, there's no guarantee this is going to work, you know? And he's like, there's no guarantee this is going to fail. Mm-hmm. So that's a mindset of somebody who's successful, right? You tell them, hey, you know, this kind of thing is not going to work. It's going to be impossible. It's like, you know, it's just not going to, you know, it might not work. Mm-hmm. And somebody like Rick Berman's like, well, there's no guarantee that it's going to fail. So
right. He's the one that says, then you go sit over there in the impossible corner and I'm going to go sit here in the doer's corner.
Yes. Another thing that reflects his mindset, which just comes out of Picard's mouth in one of his scenes, and that is where Picard says, I choose to try. In that, after that back and forth, he says, well, what I did deduce from our conversation was I choose to try, which is I want to do something as opposed to not trying to do anything at all. So another mindset of a successful person like Rick Berman is he's going to try. He's not going to not try, whatever that thing is. And then the last thing I would say that kind of reveals some of his personality was that he likes the good news first.
That was actually really cutely delivered when he says, what's he going to want to know first, the good news or the bad news? And he goes, the good news, like cut to. I was like, okay, that was cute. That actually made me audibly, you know, give a little chuckle. Yeah. Some would say laugh out loud, but I didn't really LOL. I just kind of went, huh, you know, like it was cute. It was, you know,
it was a good cut.
I liked it. Yeah.
It was a good cut. And that was a really well executed part of this episode. Mm-hmm. You know, that transition and that dialogue.
So very quickly, I also wanted to bring up Paul Lynch. You brought him up earlier, but it's just nice to see in Deep Space Nine, he did 5 episodes all in the first season, which is interesting. He did episode 4, A Man Alone. He did Babel, episode 5, episode 7, Q-Less, episode 9, The Passenger, episode 13, Battle Lines. That's 5 episodes out of 10 in a row, which is pretty impressive. So for a while, he was like their go-to guy. And then something changed. Maybe he got busy. Maybe there was a falling out. I don't know. And then before that, in The Next Generation, he did the second episode, The Naked Now, where Data and Denise Crosby hook up, Tasha Yar. Then also 11001001 with the Binars that everybody loves. In season 2, he did Unnatural Selection. And then all the way over to season 5, he does 2 episodes, which is A Matter of Time, this one, and The First Duty, which is also a good episode about an infant. No, it's actually a really good episode.
Yeah, you've been, been dealing with a lot of first duties.
Yeah. But it's actually about, well, I'm not going to tell you what it's about, but it's actually a very good episode. So it's nice that his last episode on The Next Generation is also a very memorable one. But anyway, it's time for the home run of the episode. What do you think, Siroc? I guess the home. He's making the face of like, oh, geez, I don't know, man.
The home run of the episode. I'm gonna go ahead and give it to Matt Fuhrer.
Fuhrer, don't call him Matt Fuhrer.
Yeah, I guess he doesn't like. Wouldn't like that. Fuhrer.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I think that he accomplished the goal of being annoying and irritating, and yeah, there was a point where I was like, get this guy off the ship too, and you know, I was done with him. You know, and so. that's a skill set in itself, you know, to be able to play those, that annoyance and to be irritating. Obviously, I mentioned earlier in the review that I think Dwight Schultz is the best at this exact kind of annoying character, mm-hmm. which was played on the A-Team. But Matt did a great job. Called him Max Headroom. I thought Max Headroom did a great job being annoying and really selling, because, you know, while I was watching it, I didn't say, oh, this guy's not from the future. You know, I think he sold that by the way that he didn't have to say anything, that he was from the future, you know. Yeah. So this one, I can understand why people would want to rewatch it, just based on the fact that once you know that, you know, that he's from the past, maybe you'd want to rewatch how he delivered those lines to see if there was any tells there that could have been picked up on, because I didn't see them while I was watching.
Yeah. Let me see. I feel like there are two, and I feel like one is Matt Frewer and the other one is Brent Spiner. I feel like Brent continues to give us these little moments. Sometimes they don't give him much to work with. Other times they do. This was about medium. He had a couple comedic moments, but he also had a couple lines like, you know, if your handprint works, whether you're conscious or not, you know, little things here and there. And he always does such a great job of adding so little, but we see so much in that, you know, and that's great TV acting. Wouldn't work on the stage, but it works on TV for us, and we get it, and we dissect every teeny tiny little smirk or every little head nod or what, you know, and it works for us, and we love it to death. And he has created that character, and he has done the groundwork for us to look for those little tiny data movements. It's time to say thank you to some friends that we love almost as much as we love Data. Their names are Dr. Anne-Marie Siegel, Eve England out in Wales, Yvette Blackman, Tom, TJ Jackson Bay out in Missouri, Titus Muller, Dr. Muhammad Noor, Anil O. Palat, Joe Balsarati, Mike Gu, Dr. Stephanie Baker, Carrie Schwent, Faith Howell, Edward Foltz, a.k.a. Crewman Guy. Got to ask him why he wants to be called that. The Matt Boardman, Chris McGee, Justin Weir, Jake Barrett, Henry Unger, Allison Leach Hyde, Julie Manasvi, Jed Thompson, Dr. Susan V. Gruner, Glenn Iverson, Dave Gregory, Chris Sternett, Greg K. Wickstrom, Cassandra Gerard. That's a good name. Chuck A., Chris Garris, and of course, Jason M. Oaken. All right, everybody, stick around. We've got the free-for-all up next. We will be right back on The Seventh Rule.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to The Seventh Rule with Siroc Lofton. This is the free-for-all with Melissa Lungo.
Hello there.
We've also got Jason M. Oaken here.
Hi, everybody.
Dressed in his Sunday best on a Saturday. Susan V. Gruner is also here in orange. What's up? Nice. Yay! She's got a Seventh Rule shirt.
Old school.
The Dark Lord Chris McGee's got a Walking Art Made by Melissa Seventh Rule shirt. And Faith Howell is on the bridge of the Enterprise D. Chris Garris is floating out in space. Looks like that's Scandinavia over his shoulder. I think it is. Allison Leach Hyde is here with her Abyssinian kiosk shirt. Great color. I already said Jason. Chuck A, a.k.a. TNG Fanatic, looks like he's got a family shirt, but I can't. Ferengi family. And the Matt Boardman is the property of the USS Titan. All right, everybody. Jake Sisko guesses the IMDb score.
Well, I'm going to say 6.3.
6.3. Does anybody else have any guesses that doesn't already know?
I think Ciroc is being generous.
Kind of being nice a little bit, but
6.3. You know, there's a personal opinion and maybe the IMDb. I think the IMDb is probably higher, about 6.7, but again, not a personal opinion.
Interesting.
I'm going to give it a 7.2.
7.0.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say 7.6.
See?
Whoa.
See?
That's,
we've got
alrighty.
Sean alrighty. Bradley coming from Chris McGee there.
Okay.
The answer is, of course, let me recheck the notes here, get out of the NBA song here. And I believe it is 7.2.
Oh, wow.
Good job, Chris Garris.
Got it.
All right. I'm not going to reach in your pocket for the $100, though.
Right. It's in Ciroc. I got one non-appearance mention. Khan Noonien Singh, although he just said Khan Singh. Did you guys catch any others?
O'Brien? Yep, they called to him.
Oh, I didn't catch that. Good knowledge.
Yeah,
there's also a reference to Dr. Noonien Sung.
Sung. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Oh, he also mentioned
Sung in the
scene. Yeah, when
he mentioned that, I'm Sung's revised prototype.
Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah. But then did he also mention his brother then in that sentence?
He didn't say lore, no.
I don't remember.
He just said, I'm not the first.
Right, okay.
Nor
okay. Wow, good stuff, guys. Do we have any some kinds of or some sorts of in this one? Sue's nodding her head.
Go ahead, Sue, please take it.
I don't remember. I just know there was one. Okay.
There was some kind of.
I heard one.
Jordy was commenting on the time pod saying the hull is made of some kind of plasticized tritanium mesh.
Yeah, that one again.
Plasticized tritanium mesh.
All right, Melissa Longo.
Rolls off the tongue.
Can you please get us started off on the right track by telling us what you thought of this episode?
Yeah, it was kind of fun. it was goofy and fun. But the first thing I thought, goofy and fun. the first thing I thought about when they said Rasputin's name is I thought of Rasputin and and how they both had a way of gaining trust from people that wasn't necessarily earned and or deserved. So that's what I thought. Rasputin. I kept thinking Rasputin. I was like, go away, Rasputin. You stink. And what else? Oh, but there was a line in this that I really enjoyed that really, well, I wouldn't say enjoyed is the right word, but it had an impact. It was when Picard says, your arguments have reminded me how precious the right to choose is. Mm. And that is probably the best part of the entire episode. Because it's spot on. The importance of the right to choose should never be taken away from anyone. And then there was another thing. Oh, Worf. I love Worf and how he hates questionnaires. I hate questionnaires. but yes, it seemed that... they were a little too eager to trust this guy that says he was from another time. Yes, he was from another time, but that could mean anything. That doesn't automatically mean he's a good dude. So, I didn't hate it. I didn't dislike it. It was entertaining, but, you know, there's a lot of nitpicks and things left unsaid.
Looking forward to that. Great stuff, Melissa Longo. Thank you very much. Jason M. Oaken is here. You hinted earlier that you have some thoughts on this episode. What are they?
It's a wonderful episode, and I'll say a few of these things before I take off for Sears in my Sunday best.
Speaking of Sears, this is about somebody that could see the future or knew about the future.
Absolutely.
Okay.
This sort of, in my view, is not the strongest entry in the fifth season. I see this episode as being stuck in this kind of a purgatory. It's not serious enough, and it's not sort of doesn't go all the way sort of toward comedy. So it's kind of stuck in the middle of nowhere. Frankly, I think it's to a large degree the fault of the script. I don't think we have enough of jeopardy of that jeopardy. We don't feel like anything is really in jeopardy. They're talking about the entire planet potentially being incinerated, but we haven't seen any of those people. It's hard to sympathize with anybody. And then Picard makes a decision about potentially just killing everybody on the planet by himself in a room. Now there's, you know, Melissa mentioned this whole sort of philosophical discussion about choice, and that perhaps is, it is the highlight of the episode, but I think that pretty much is it. It's very, very thin. I mean, it's really not a big secret that this was written for Robin Williams, who couldn't do this. And not that Matt Frewer is a bad actor, but they, yeah, to really sort of pull this out, you needed somebody really maybe even more over the top. I mean, he's kind of chewing it there, but it's sort of like not kind of low key enough and not over the top enough to kind of take over the episode. And you needed somebody like this, maybe somebody like Robin Williams to rescue this and sort of take it to another level, because otherwise it's kind of meh. It's kind of a neither here nor there. It's okay. I mean, it's kind of a lighter episode after, you know, Unification, but for something like this, which is pretty much a bottle show. I mean, they had one set that was, I think, just basically a reuse of a set that they built earlier. So it wasn't anything that they spent money on. It had to captivate you. And I think it failed to do that. Mm. So it's kind of it's a miss in my book for certainly for the fifth season.
Sorry, Jason. Thanks very much, Jason M. Oaken. Great stuff, as always. All right, Susan V. Gruner, your thoughts? What do you think of this one?
I thought it was boring. Totally boring.
Sirach is nodding with every answer here so far.
I don't have any comments, but I have questions. How did he know everybody's name on the ship? And did they have Bluetooth weapons or Wi-Fi weapons that they were able to somehow make the phasers not work? I'm just curious. Be very interesting. The guy creeped me out. I did not like his. He looked like a slob to me. And you know, I care about how people dress and everything. I thought the guy's totally slobbed out. Wrong. I hate him already. Why didn't they ask for more proof? Why did they just believe him? Why couldn't Troy tell that he was lying? There's just so many questions. And what was the reason for the questionnaires? Exactly what was he going to do with those? Go back and pretend to invent more stuff and sell it? I mean, the whole thing to me was just a mess. I hate to be so negative, but yeah, no. I wrote, no point, boring.
That was a lot of questions. I bet you got more though, and you're just sparing us.
No, I wrote Rasmussen was creepy right from the start. When guys creep me out, the hairs on my arm raise up, and that doesn't happen very often. Usually it's when I'm in the physical presence of a creep. The hairs on my arm raised up. The guy,
it did for this episode. That's insane. All right.
Oh, man.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Susan V. Gruner. I bet there's more. We'll talk about it in Things Left Unsaid. The Chris McGee is here. He's the Dark Lord, everybody knows. What are your thoughts on this episode?
Well, unlike most of us here, I'm not ashamed to say that this is one of my favorite episodes of TNG. Sure, it may be full of plot holes if you think about it, but it's just fun to turn off your brain and just enjoy the watch. Matt Frewer is a delight to watch in almost anything he appears in. Most people know him, of course, from the Max Headroom franchise starting in the late 1980s. After seeing this episode once and knowing the real reason Rasmussen traveled to the 24th century, many things become quite clear or viewed in a different light upon a second viewing. Such as the 10 forward scene, Riker's questionnaire, even Picard drilling Rasmussen for the fate of the colonists. We do get another Jay sighting in this episode, where she's talking with Geordi in the engineering. Speaking of cringe moments, Susan, did anyone else cringe when Rasmussen said, "Some of my best friends are empaths"?
Yes.
Also, the time pod is definitely a paradox because there's not much headroom in it, even with headroom in it.
Oh, nice. Oh. I see what you did there.
The memorable quote of the episode, holy cow, there are so many that I remembered. I'll just pick one here. Rasmussen saying, "So do nothing and thousands will die. Do something and millions could die." That's a tough choice. But before I go, I am speaking for Carrie here, who is not here. She says that it is certainly an interesting episode. Her favorite part being the main guest star, of course. Her favorite non-Trek role for him is the 1994 miniseries The Stand, where he plays the trash can man and is brilliant.
And he said, he kept saying bomb-de-bomb. I remember that guy. Yeah, he was really cool. Great character.
So the limerick, naturally, is about him. All the best con men know just what to do. They have the skills to make their words sound true. But I went and got greedy. In the end, they saw through me. I really should not have messed with this crew.
Excellent work, Chris McGee and Carrie Schwent. Yeah, The Stand. Oh, what a great callback. That's good stuff. Thanks very much. All right, Faith Howell, I cannot wait. This is going to be so exciting. Is this a dip in a great season, or is this just another great episode in a great season?
It is a dip in a great season, but it's still leaps and bounds above, you know, season two, for example. So to me, there are some standout things in this episode. It is very memorable, probably because of Rasmussen's character. He is just so thoroughly unlikable, and we only see him the one time. So there's no chance of redeeming himself. So we have other characters that are sort of unlikable, like Barclay at the beginning, but the longer we spend with him, the more you find something that you can attach yourself to and sort of just get along with him. But Rasmussen is the one and done obnoxious character, picks on Data, who is, you know, everybody's favorite, right? So we gotta get rid of that guy. But one of the things I really appreciate about this episode is the innocence. Like I mentioned before that this episode reminded me and made me think of Ryan while I was watching, because
I'm innocent.
Ryan, some of you guys have noticed, likes to tell me things, and he is completely lying to my face, and I believe him every single time. I feel so gullible when I hang out with Ryan. But what? I love that innocence. Like, I don't want to lose that innocence about myself, because why would I second guess somebody that is my friend and would, you know, why would anybody tell me a lie? So I like that they embrace this guy, even though they're all kind of giving him the side eye of, you know, I really just don't like you and I don't have any reason to trust you, but you seem like you came from the future. And why should I look at that too hard? You have this technology that we don't have and can't understand. And, you know, it makes sense. So I like that they sort of leaned into that more than they, you know, they absolutely could have picked him apart and thrown him out from the get-go. So, yeah, that's why I thought of you, Ryan, because
thank you. What a great compliment. this guy that lies and I want to throw him out of the airlock. But anyway, this is my favorite episode.
I will always believe you, Ryan. So just
thank you.
Treat me gently, okay?
Thank you very much, Faith Howell. She has faith in me. Thank you. Allison Leachhide is up next. What do you think of this one, Allison?
Well, you know, this one actually was one I didn't see a lot as a kid. It wasn't on syndication a lot. So I saw this one when I was older. And I love Matt Pure. So, and he's so fun and creepy in this episode. So I enjoy this episode. I think, like, I know that the science bit with Geordi is, there's a lot of technobabble that's going on, but I also think that's super cool. I really like in this episode that we see the entire crew. They all have something to do. No one is really passed up. So I think that is great. I love the scene between Rasmussen and Beverly in sick bay. I think she is trying to be very diplomatic and get away from him and how he kept blocking her. And by how I love it because it was very well done. But as a woman, I also just wanted to like punch him in the face. Like, you can't be in my space. Block me like that. So, but I thought it was really well done and she was being very diplomatic. And yeah, so I do. I think it's fun. And yeah, is it great? No, but it is fun. So I do enjoy watching this one. Yeah, I think that's about all I got. And I mean, they won an Emmy for it. So that's kind of cool for outstanding individual achievement in special effects. And it's tied with Conundrum from this season as well. So that's super cool. I'm guessing it's for like all the shooting and relieving pressure and making carbon monoxide and all of that. You know, it's also interesting that they were kind of going in on, you know, some topical things of greenhouse gases and whatnot, because that was definitely big in the 90s that we were talking about. So they were trying to make it topical and they made it fun too. So nothing wrong with that.
Great stuff. That's a good point. Thank you very much, Allison Leachhide out in New Mexico. Adjacent to New Mexico, Chris Garris in Texas. What are your thoughts on this episode?
I actually enjoyed this episode. Yeah, I mean, it's got some, you know, creepy parts here and there, like you were saying with him and Beverly. You beat me to it. I was like, oh, she said it because no one had said it. But no, it was fun, kind of beat, and, you know, and I did not notice it originally when I watched, because this is not my first time seeing it, but, you know, you don't actually notice him picking up all the little items, the phasers and all that stuff. But of course, now I'm like watching, okay, he got that, he got that. And, you know, and then just the speech that him, the talk that him and Picard had was just, you know, one of the best ones, you know, and so far in this season. And it's so true, like, you know, if he does something or he doesn't do something, it's just the same outfit. It's the same outcome, regardless if this guy tells him. Now, I did like how they did kind of figured out that he was basically lying, was when he was scared on the bridge. Because if he was truly from the future, he shouldn't have been worried about what was going on, because he should have known. And that's kind of what they realized. He should have known that what they did was going to work. So that was another, you know, a tale that gave away his, you know, his lie. But yeah, overall, I mean, it's got its, you know, its quirks. And yes, he's not one of the ones that we'd ever like to see back. Now, I am kind of curious of what did they do? He's from the 22nd century. So where did he go? Is he in Starfleet jail, or did they just kick him out to the road? You know, I mean, he's got a lot of learning to do, kind of like, but, you know, I don't know if they made him a scientist like they did Jillian in, you know, Star Trek IV. But overall, I mean, it's just a fun episode to come off of all these, you know, these heavy ones we've had prior to. So yeah, it's a good watch.
It's a fun one. Oh, yeah. Thanks very much, Chris Garris, out in Southeast Texas. Chuck A, aka TNG Fanatic, you love this episode, don't you?
I really like the episode. I wouldn't say love it, but it was had its. Moments. It did have its cringy moments and nitpicks. I did notice something that no one's mentioned. The scientists that were on the planet were wearing silver jumpsuits, and it was the same jumpsuit that the gentleman who found Data in Time's Arrow, and what Purple Data said in Lower Decks about he was discovered by a man in a silver jumpsuit. I went back and looked at both episodes. It was the same jumpsuit. All the scientists were wearing that jumpsuit. And of course, the one gentleman in Time Zero was wearing that same jumpsuit. So, you know, they love to reuse costumes and uniforms. I thought that was interesting. The other thing that I really liked was right towards the end of the episode where where he's having the discussion with Rasmussen in the ready room. He was listening to Picard and saying, there's nothing I can tell you. I can't do anything. And he was really interested in Livingston the fish. He kept on looking at him more than looking at Picard. But, you know, it was at that point, I'm sure Picard knew that this guy wasn't who he said he was. I thought it was a very good scene. And one last thing is the interactions that Rasmussen had with Data when Data was listening to all the music. What was it, a couple hundred simultaneous musics? And he says, you're only down to four. He says, well, a good deal of my concentration is on this event here on the planet. I thought it was a very nice scene with Rasmussen and Data. But, you know, I liked the episode quite a bit. I agree with some of the nitpicks that people have said and the cringy moment with Beverly. But overall, I did enjoy the episode.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Chuck A, a.k.a. TNG Fanatic. All right, the Matt Boardman, your thoughts? Is that the same? Do you have the same background as I do? I think so.
Almost. Almost.
Almost. All right.
It's in the same. It's in the same scene.
What do you think of this one?
I don't know why, but this is one of those episodes that for no reason in particular, I'm just not a fan of. You know, it's not that there's anything intrinsically wrong with it. It is a little slow. Not a whole lot happens, but it just, I don't know. Maybe it's just because I grew up not so much seeing Matt Fuhrer as Max Headroom, but seeing him as the dad of the other kids in Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. And so every time I see him there, like my kid brain had a hard time separating the two. I don't know. It just his character seemed so out of place. But there are some fun things in this, you know. For example, the scene when they're in 10 Forward and they're all kind of discussing the fact that this dude comes in here and he's got this questionnaire. And how many of us have been at work and we're so annoyed by somebody who comes in and wants us to fill out? It's like, bro, I got so many other things to do today and you want me to do one more thing on top of all of that? You know, like, tell me your feelings on this or whatever. But the other thing that's really kind of struck me is how funny it is that somebody, like, you know, we hear that phrase, if you act like you belong there, people will believe it. And this dude was like the poster child for that, right? He walks in and he's just like, yeah, I know things about, you know, time travel, whatever. I'm this guy, you know, and they all were just kind of like, okay, sure. Why don't you, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know why it just... That to me just strikes me as so funny, and it made me kind of do a callback to when Worf first gets to DS9 and he's trying to be like big man on campus with Odo in terms of security, and says, well, we didn't have these problems on the Enterprise. And this is one of the things that Odo points out in his, like, really? Why don't we go down the list? By the way, you know, it was this incident. So anyway, I don't know. I guess, you know, it's an okay episode. Probably not one of my favorites, but you know, not a bad, horrible entry into the mythos of the Next Generation.
Excellent work. Thank you very much, the Matt Boardman. All right. Jake's final take. So just hit my mic. Yeah, final thoughts on this episode, Sirach. It seems like most people are in the Sirach camp of this episode.
I mean, the episode was slow for me. I just thought it was, you know, I wrote it down in my notes. Slow episode. I even drew a little clock.
just to really hammer it home.
That's it. So that's
not a ticking
notes.
Clock. Not a ticking clock.
No, not that one. It's just like, I was just like, no, come on with the story already. Give me something else. Give me something more. I wanted a little bit more there. It didn't give it to me. But not to knock Matt Frewer's performance, you know, he did give a very annoying performance, and he was good at that. But I just felt like the story lacked a little bit. I did like the ring watch that he popped out. Like my curiosity would want to see that little ring watch that he had in the episode. And even just the guys that designed it, you know, when he was checking the time and he flipped over his ring watch for his finger. I thought that was pretty cool. Yeah. He said, I'm from a place called New Jersey. Like we never heard of that. It was kind of weird, but I was like, all right, okay. Stealing data again. It's like, boy, how many times are they going to try to steal data? I mean, this guy, we got to get him a kryptonite lock or something on his foot.
Air tag.
An air tag, that guy. what else do I have here? Yeah, you know, I'm trying to pull as much as I can out of the episode. It wasn't, you know, I did like the moment when Dr. Crusher says, yeah, I can be your great, great. And it's like, the more greats you put on it, the farther away we're getting from my theme song of the NBA, right? it was the opposite of effect was happening for him. And so, yeah, I thought that was hilarious. I loved how she kind of pushed him back with that. I felt a little uncomfortable that he was given access to all over the ship. It's like, nobody's going to get access to any vessel. I don't care if it's a Navy vessel or a aircraft, or it's just, you just don't get full carte blanche privilege to access, the engines, the main, you know, you can't just walk around here unpermitted, you know, without any kind of restrictions. I have to reiterate that Starfleet protocol always uses time travel in a covert way. So giving out questionnaires and a time travel thing is affecting the time. It is. So like you wouldn't do that. You would try to be as covert as possible and be inconspicuous and off to the back and off to the side. You wouldn't be sitting in Riker's chair, passing out questionnaires and asking and interrupting people while they're doing their work. Like Data was actually computing, LaForge was actually doing computations, and he was like questioning them, which was interfering for their work. So again, that just wouldn't happen. And so I felt like that was a big tell that he wasn't from the future, nor also that he wasn't trained underneath Starfleet protocols. And then my last thing that I'll say is we have a system of law in this country where we don't do cruel and unusual punishment. And I would imagine that that would carry forward into the world of Star Trek and Starfleet, that cruel and unusual punishment would be something we try to stay away from. And in my opinion, were stealing a camcorder or whatever devices that he was stealing that were laying around that station or that ship does not equate to being left out of your time zone and putting missing that opportunity to go back to a time zone. So I don't think that the punishment fits the crime in this particular instance. They basically separate him from hundreds of years of time from where he comes from and whatnot. And I just think that's an unusual punishment for petty theft, which is what I think that would fall under. I understand he was trying to, you know, pretend to invent all of these things, but I wasn't really satisfied with the resolution there. Welcome to the 24th century. Like, well, you know, too bad for you.
I love that line, by the way. You know, there was a 4 or 5 letter word that they were thinking right after that line. Welcome to the 24th century.
So yeah, but overall it moved a little slow for me. Didn't get much of a B story. Kind of all fell in together with one giant A story, in my opinion. And yeah, I, you know, I did like the reaction shots from the actors that did not like the presence of this guy. I did enjoy watching them distrust and their face of disapproval. But, you know, overall, it's a filler episode. They just came off a back-to-back Spock episode. And so I imagine they blew a lot of their budget mid-season for that. And they're trying to just, you know, tread water at this point in the middle of the season, towards the middle of the season. So I'm just imagining that, you know, this will do as far as, you know, being a filler episode. Wasn't as bad as some of the stuff we've seen in the early seasons of this show. So I'm not going to condemn it like that. Just wasn't on par with some of the great episodes that we've seen this season in season five. Which they've kind of set a high bar for themselves by giving us really good material. So that's all.
So Spock was the reason they couldn't afford Robin Williams in this episode. We did mention Robin Williams, Jason. So yeah, guys actually mentioned a few things that we were talking about at the beginning there. Pretty cool. Also, before we go, check this out. Here's something fun that... Allison shows us. It's a...
Oh, I remember those. The ring watch, the Casio, right?
Yeah. And then we also have that Chris McGee shows us. Same kind of thing.
Okay.
Oh, cool.
Also fun.
That's cool.
All right, Razor Ramon. Did I hear a Razor Ramon impression? Okay, somebody got that joke or that reference. That's it for us. Thank you to Matt Boardman, Chuck A., Allison Leach-Hyde, Faith Howell, Chris McGee, Susan V. Gruner, Chris Garris, who's gone, Jason M. Oaken, Melissa Longo, for myself, Siroc, Melissa, and Mr. Aaron Eisenberg. Thank you all very much for hanging out with us. We will see you next time. And until then, always remember the seventh rule.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach integrier- und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.